One out of two adults suffers from at least one chronic condition, from back pain and migraines to autoimmune issues and cancer. Sometimes a bunch of conditions at once. Well, that was the story of our guest today, who found her health problems sucking the joy from her life, along with her energy. This hour, how she used her own brain to find her way back, and her blueprint for helping other people do the same. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert with you today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Donna Jackson Nakazawa joins us this hour. She's an award-winning science journalist, and her new book is called The Last Best Cure. Well, Donna Jackson Nakazawa, thank you so much for joining us.
It's such a pleasure to be here.
So when you started on this journey, how would you describe your health? Where was it, and what is it that you'd been through already?
Well, when I started the journey, as I started the book, and excuse me, I'm getting over a little cold, so bear with me. I was in a place where I had been a revolving door patient at Johns Hopkins with some of the most amazing medical practitioners of our time. And I had tried a whole slew of Eastern protocols as well. I'd done pretty much everything that a science journalist could do, east, west, and in the middle. And I was still at a place where, with my autoimmune conditions, just climbing the stairs with a basket of laundry was a lot for me. I've been through multiple periods of paralysis with one of my autoimmune conditions and really had beat the odds over and over and over again. And yet, I found myself one night lying at the top of those stairs with my two young, beautiful children stepping over me, realizing that they had become accustomed to stepping over Mom on the floor. Mm. And as my son said, "Can you practice my French verbs?" and my daughter asked where her lacrosse jersey was, I realized, you know, these were the years. This was it. This is all we get. And I couldn't feel joyful because every moment was going into what I called managing the pain channel. I was on the pain channel and I wanted to get on the life channel, and a decade of the pain channel was long enough.
Right. And so you said these spells of paralysis that you worked through. I guess that's something like Guillain-Barré syndrome, isn't it?
Yes. It's similar to MS, but with a more kind of sudden strike to the myelin sheaths and with a more uncertain outcome. And the first time it took me about a month to get back out of a state where I couldn't use my legs. And the second time was really a good 6 months. And the long-term effects of that on the body, you never really fully regain your neurological system to the extent that you might like.
And so that was part of it. You had a blood clotting disorder. So when you fell down, it sounds like there was a lot of blood and it freaked your kids out. And that was part of it, too. I mean, and I think the most telling thing at the beginning of this, you go to a new doctor and she does all these labs so that you can just get a good baseline on where you are. And the labs came back and they were something else, weren't they?
Yes. You know, my doctor left the area to go up to Boston, and I had loved her. And she said, "You know what, I think you're really going to like the person I'm turning your file over to." And I went in and I met the new doctor, and I have always had an attitude where the less said about my medical conditions, the better, because, you know, who wants to think about all that? My thing is, I'm living a normal life. Let's not talk about it. And I was dreading going in and talking to my new doctor and doing that thing that patients who have chronic illness will recognize very well when you step into a new doctor's office and you have to give the litany, right? The whole story of this happened and this happened and I have this, 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 and this.
And all the medications you're on.
Right. Yeah. And I walked in her office and she listened to all that. And she said, "You know, we know your work. I've lectured for Hopkins. I've keynoted large conferences for them." And she knew my book, The Autoimmune Epidemic. And she said, "You know, I know your work. You're fabulous. That's great. But have you ever considered that you need to translate for patients who have tried all that Western medicine has to offer that the brain may be the last best cure. And I tell you, in that moment, you know, that moment where for a journalist, the sea kind of parts, and you think to yourself, I need to walk through that sea. I had been keeping files myself on a growing area of research called psychoneuroimmunology. In the book, I break that down to PIN, P-I-N, because nobody likes a word that long. it's hard to write it so many times. But the science of psychoneuroimmunology really spoke to the fact that when we are able to change our brain state, we are able to change the neurochemicals within our entire body. And when we are able to change the neurochemicals in our entire body, we are able to change the state of our cells. And this, you know, Harvard is devoting a great deal of research to this, every major research institution. So we came up with an idea. By changing my state of mind, by trying to get off the pain channel and onto the life channel, by using a series of very well-studied techniques, would we be able to change what was happening in my body? And to get to your question, yes, to do that, we had to do quite a bit of blood work. And she took 17 vials of blood. And as you said, the results were not pleasant. There was a lot going on in my body that was, you know, disturbing. And some of which was taking place in my bone marrow. And I knew at that moment, this was a journey I absolutely had to take.
And you were sitting there in her office, one of your first visits, and she asks you some questions, you know, to get the lay of the land of your body, your health. But she also asked you a question that completely caught you by surprise, right? She asked you about your childhood.
Completely caught me by surprise. I have been a science journalist for a very long time, and I tend to cover trends before they come down the pike for people sitting in their living rooms picking up their newspapers. And she caught me completely off guard when she said, you know, your immune system just isn't, it keeps taking these hits and taking these hits. Something is going on in the wiring of your immune system, in the way that it's set up to regulate any kind of hit that comes into your body. Did anything happen in your childhood that might have played a role in how your immune system learned to react? And I couldn't wrap my head around it because, you know, I am a science journalist and I was talking to a very well-known medical clinician and the director of integrative medicine in internal medicine at Johns Hopkins. And it took her about 5 minutes to help me understand that I needed to investigate a growing body of research, not just in psychoneuroimmunology or how state of mind affects our cells, but how the set point for how our immune system will react to any kind of incoming threat, be it a toxin, a virus, or the stresses that we face, which are as damaging to the body as a toxin, that set point for how well we can modulate our stress and immune response is set in childhood. Hmm. And the more adversity that we face in childhood, and this is work coming out of the Centers for Disease Control and Kaiser Permanente, a 17-year study has told us that the amount of adversity that we face in childhood has a direct relationship in how our immune system is set for life. That is a big thing to wrap your mind
about. Yeah, doesn't that blow your mind? I mean, you sort of think that you'd like to be able to just put your childhood behind you no matter what happened and go on and be a healthy, functioning adult, maybe with the help of some therapy. But it sounds like there are these health switches that get flipped on and they stay on for the rest of your life unless you are consciously trying to turn that wheel in the other direction.
And you're so right. And the good news is that the brain is what we call an epigenetically privileged place. Epigenetics are really how this relationship between childhood trauma or childhood adversity and adult chronic illness comes to be. And that is the fact that, in, you know, we have our DNA, But how our DNA expresses within our body in our lifetime is set by what we call epigenetic changes. And in children who have had adverse events, significant adverse events, and I'll make clear, my father went into the hospital when I was 12 for a routine surgery and died from a medical error. And a great many things ensued from that one day of my life and that colossal loss that any child would feel that created a very different state of mind than I might have had had that not happened. And what happens when these kinds of things happen to us in childhood, it isn't that we don't recover, it isn't that we aren't strong and we don't go on, but the brain produces sets of neurochemicals that literally shrink the hippocampus. And the hippocampus is where we store memories. It helps modulate the amygdala, which is the fear response center of the brain. It plunges us into fight or flight. When that happens at a young age, a neurochemical change takes place, and something called gene methylation takes place. That's another fancy word for epigenetic change. Literally altering the genetic expression for how we will produce stress hormones and neurochemicals for the rest of our life and how we will react to stress for the rest of our lives, which will in turn cause us to produce more harmful inflammatory neurochemicals for the rest of our life. That's a lot in one sentence.
I mean, it's a lot to take in. It definitely is, because that represents a new way of thinking about chronic illnesses. So it sounds like you're saying if you're someone who suffers from this host of sort of epidemic chronic illnesses that lots of people have, one out of every two adults has a chronic illness, that maybe, you know, ask yourself, did you have one of these adverse childhood experiences? And not so you can relive it and work through, you know, the whatever the issues were in a therapist's office, but that you can, you know, kind of try to rewire your brain. But before we go any further, tell us what counts as an adverse childhood experience. There's a list of them, right?
Yes. Well, great question. So this work came out of the CDC and Kaiser Permanente and two really visionary clinicians and scientists decided to, they were seeing an unusual correlation between the number of people who were coming in with pretty intense constellations of chronic illness and little things coming out in the exam room that indicated that things had happened to them in their childhood. So they decided to do this longitudinal study, the largest ever done. And what they found was that when they gave patients who came in for routine checkups something called an ACE score questionnaire, or adverse childhood experience, and asked them the following questions, and I'll break those down quickly. They include a parent with a mental illness, including depression, so you can imagine how common that is, a parent with an addiction, including alcoholism, we know how common that is, the loss of a parent, either to separation or death. Parental divorce has since worked into further ACE scoring. It was not in the original one, but it is certainly worked into it, so we know how common that is. And then going to more extreme things, sexual abuse, physical abuse, living in a home with someone who had been incarcerated for any amount of time. And the list is kind of goes from the common to the extreme. But when you think about it, that's a lot of people. If you think about the people you know who have had one of those experiences, it turns out to be 60% of us answer at least yes to at least one of those questions.
Wow.
40% of us answer yes to at least two. As the research has become more fine-grained, the statistical relationship, for instance, between women who have experienced two or more ACEs in midlife being hospitalized with a chronic autoimmune condition, their chances of that go up 20% for each ACE they've had. So the ability of scientists today to put these associations together, migraines tend to be highly correlated to adversity in childhood. And these studies are now replicated over and over and over. And as two of the scientists I talked to who were involved in this research, one of them said that when they first saw these statistics coming back, it stunned them. It was beyond any correlation that they had ever imagined. And the other one said, to see the amount of human suffering out there made him sit down and weep.
Wow. Well, so now that we're at this point, we've seen the damage that these childhood traumas can have. And you said they run from sort of, you know, the pedestrian depression. Lots of people are depressed, to abuse, neglect. What do we do about it? I mean, what recourse is there to start healing from this, healing the body in a real physiological way?
Well, I think there's so much good news, and I'm always a good news person. I couldn't ever write a book if I didn't have good news to share. And the good news is that whether we've suffered from ACEs or not, if we find ourselves in a condition in adulthood where we're facing a lot of chronic conditions, chances are that our brain is not in the greatest place, because managing that is difficult, right? It takes us to a place where we're in a state of constantly trying to get away from our worries and concerns over symptoms and lab tests and so on and so forth. And whether that started in childhood or not, that kind of state of the brain being in fight or flight or being on the pain channel, the fabulous news is that, as I said earlier, the brain is an epigenetically privileged place. And that means that in real time, we can affect the genetic expression of how we are managing the stresses in our lives, managing the stress hormones and neurochemicals that go forth into the body to create the inflammation that we're trying to walk away from. So by doing really simple things like learning how to meditate, pursuing yoga, working through different breath techniques, we can begin to change the wiring in the brain and how our body expresses stress hormones when we face the everyday stress that we have, to the point that we can reverse much of this damage. So it's great news.
And that is more of the story that we'll hear when we come back, as we speak with Donna Jackson Nakazawa. She's an award-winning science journalist, and her new book is called The Last Best Cure. And what about your story? Do you hear yourself in some of what Donna is talking about with her struggles with chronic illness? And do you need advice for finding your way back to health? Or maybe you're skeptical that the yoga and mindfulness could do the trick for some of these severe illnesses. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And you can also check in on our Facebook page at The Veronica Rickard Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickard back with you today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up at 11 o'clock, it's Larry Mueller, who says there's plenty of work to do in the garden before the soil warms up. On Garden Talk, Larry finds out how, when, and how much to prune, plus how to identify lingering effects of the drought. That's 11 o'clock on Larry Mueller. I'm Veronica Rickert. This hour, we're talking with Donna Jackson Nakazawa, who's joining us. She has written a new book called The Last Best Cure, and she is an award-winning science journalist. Talking about her personal story, coming back from just a host of chronic illnesses that really left her depleted, not able to enjoy her family life, and having the joy kind of leached away from her day-to-day existence, and how she got back using new techniques about how to work with the brain and to reduce inflammation in the body and the response, the stress response in the body as well. And we're happy to take your call as well if this sounds familiar to you at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And so, Donna, before we went into break, we were talking about, you know, the good news, and this is about good news. You mentioned yoga and mindfulness. Acupuncture is a part of this picture. Where did you personally start when you wanted to just begin at square one?
Well, great question. And one thing I just want to make clear is that I never had as an end game in this process that I was going to be, you know, able to go scuba diving again. To me, the end game was simply to get away from the chronic spinning tapes in my own mind that revolved around the pain and the symptoms of chronic illness. And so it isn't about necessarily getting to a place where you're 100%. It's about getting to a place where you feel joy and well-being again. And so I started with that as my beginning point. And to do that, I worked with my doctor, and we felt that not only was most of the scientific literature on minimizing chronic illness symptoms coming out of the world of mindfulness and mindfulness-based stress reduction, but that was also going to be a really important place for me to start because of the way that I was experiencing life, to get to a place where I could find a way to take a pause and not listen to the tracks on the pain channel, but start to hear what is on the life channel, that was going to be the most important place for me to start. And physiologically, the reason for that is because our body has two stress responses. One comes through what we call the sympathetic nervous system. I call it the stress now system instead of SNS, because I know all these words are really hard for people to hold on to. So instead of SNS for sympathetic nervous system, just think stress now system. It's fight or flight. It's our evolutionary biology. When we saw a tiger, you know, back in the cave days, we had to have this ability to run or throw the spear, so all the blood goes into our arms and legs and away from our brain, and our body floods with neurochemicals and cytokines, which whip up that inflammatory response. And then there's the parasympathetic nervous system, or PNS, which I call the purr-now system. It's a kitty cat purring. It's our state of homeostasis. It's what we were intended to always come back to in between moments of fight or flight. But in modern life, what scientists are finding is that we never come back to the purr-now system, the parasympathetic nervous system response. We are living as if every bill that comes in the mail, every traffic altercation, every argument with our spouse is the tiger, right? Mm-hmm. So we're always activating the stress now system. The stress now system, in bottom line terms, equals inflammatory neurochemicals. So to get out of that stress now system and into the purr now system required me to change my state of mind. And nothing is more powerful for that than mindfulness practice. So that is where I began, because to start with the inside of the body and then move later to the outside through yoga and exercise seemed like a logical progression.
And what were those first sessions like for you as someone who was in this, you know, locked into this years-long stress response? What was it like?
Very difficult. I went to practice with a woman who is in my area locally and has done a lot of research with Johns Hopkins, but also in running small groups in the community for learning mindfulness-based techniques. And I would go to her course and sit there with a group of 12 other people, very similar to myself, with different stories of emotional or physical challenges that they were facing and wanted to try to help manage through mindfulness. And I'd be sitting there and all I could think was, you know, my legs are going numb. I can't sit cross-legged like this. Well, what am I going to do? How am I going to get up and shake my legs out so that they don't go numb? You know, and there would go 10, 20 minutes, and I'd start thinking about how I was going to make the rest of the day work, because I'd taken this time to do this, but I had a deadline, and I had two kids to pick up from school. And to learn that we can, with will and discipline and practice, step back from this overwhelming cacophony of feelings and emotions simply by entering the body, entering the breath, and entering a pause between that overwhelming sense of stress feelings or stress now system, and that we have the ability by entering our body through the tricks that mindfulness teaches us and enter the per now system is a gift that this 1 year journey gave me that I am forever grateful for. It's life changing.
And it was only a year. I mean, when you think about the years, plural, that you suffered with all of this, and in 1 year you were back to a place of wellness, that's something.
And again, wellness is defined differently for different people. And as someone who spent, you know, a great deal of time in and out of a wheelchair for several years, I don't see wellness as necessarily physical perfection. And I can't say that, you know, right now I could go run a marathon. I can't. But I am in a place where I feel differently when I do have to manage symptoms. And my blood work is different, too. So on multiple levels, I have increased my access to a place of wellness. And I think that's a really great outcome, no matter where you are and where you start. To get to a better place is through very simple techniques is an extraordinary gift that we can give ourselves. And I want to say one other thing about that. We have lots of drugs for taking the stress now system, fight or flight, sympathetic nervous system, and dampening it down. We have beta blockers for rushing heart rate. We have all kinds of anxiety medications, and we have plenty of antidepressants. And we even have inflammatory drugs for autoimmune diseases to help dampen down that immune response that's related to the stress now system, the inflammatory response. So we've really been great about that. We do not have a single drug to pump up or bring on the per now system or the parasympathetic nervous system. Not one. It is only accessible through mind, brain, body techniques.
So that's the work that we have to do ourselves.
Well, and that's all we get.
Maybe that's a good thing. Well, let's go and take our first caller. We have Jackie who's joining us from Waukesha. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. Hey, I was listening to how you were saying that when you're little, if you have these ACE experiences, that the hippocampus shrinks and that you're less able to manage stress. And in later years, to me, it seems like it would be the opposite. Like if we're exposed and if we're exposed to those experiences, it would seem to me that it prepares you. It would expand your hippocampus and prepare us more to handle those in later years because we were exposed in younger years.
Kind of like getting immunity from being exposed to a virus, that kind of thing?
Yeah, like that, yeah.
Okay, well, let's see. I don't know if that's an interesting theory, but how does that play out, Donna?
Well, that would be so great. I think that would be wonderful. And I think that that is the old thinking that, you know, people who experienced a lot of adversity in childhood are tougher. And I think that that is one of the reasons why the two researchers who started this paradigm shift in medicine, and where they now have established an entire center at Harvard for studying this biological connection between adversity in childhood and later health outcomes in adulthood, that is why this is such a huge paradigm shift, is because we have always assumed that, you know, what doesn't kill you will make you stronger, and that kids who've been through these things in childhood will have a leg up when, you know, when life is hard later. And to some extent, the caller is correct that there is a small kernel of truth in that. That if you have just a small degree of adversity, not one of these big ACEs, what we call wobble, what neuropsychiatrists like to call wobble, little bits of, you know, toughness. You had a something happen. You know, your parents weren't perfect. No one's parents are perfect. That you need a little wobble to get strong. But there's a point at which wobble turns to adversity, and the neurochemicals do a number on our brain, and there's just no way around it. We now have over 300 studies repeating this relationship and showing it. So we're past the point of wondering if it's true. The medical community is now wondering, what do we do about the fact that it is true?
Okay, well, thank you, Jackie. That's a good question. And we'll go next to Rick, who's joining us from Woodruff. Hi, Rick.
Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for this wonderful show.
Oh, sure.
I'm a medical provider, and I just wanted to resonate with what Donna was describing. Sometimes we see individuals with remarkable resiliency, but there's a tipping point where they're overwhelmed. My concern as a provider is oftentimes the opportunity to really listen to the client or the patient is inhibited by the production model. And my dream would be that we'd move toward more of an outcome in healthcare where listening, asking the type of questions that were the foundation for Donna's recovery would be an opportunity. I also wanted to mention that, and I think you had Dr. Davidson on recently, Dr. Richard Davidson and his work has demonstrated some of the benefits in terms of psychoneuroimmunology in his research. And I think Dr. Ned Kalin, also at UW, in looking at early childhood issues, has been demonstrating some similar findings. So thank you for this wonderful show. And let's just hope that healthcare moves toward that opportunity to listen and empower clients, patients, consumers to recovery.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Rick, for calling. Appreciate it. And Richard Davidson actually was just on the show last week, as it happens. And you know, some of what this raises to me, Donna, is if we know that these are important questions about what happened in our past, we're really looking at a medical model where the whole person needs to be considered, including their life history, not just their medical history, but their life history.
Absolutely. And I so applaud the caller's point. We are starting to see a great deal of interest on the statewide level across the country for working this new ACE paradigm into our understanding of childhood health and looking at the pyramid of, okay, if we have these events in childhood and they go unnoticed and unexamined, then later we're going to have more and more and more chronic immune-mediated dysfunction. I think that makes it a little bit easier for people to understand that rather than say, well, your childhood makes you sick, because, you know, there's a different range of situation and outcome for every individual based on a multifactorial list of things from their genetics to the environment that they're exposed to chemically. It isn't just your childhood. But to look at that question of how that might impact our population 20, 30 years hence, and what that means for rising rates of chronic conditions in this country is a really important question. And on state levels, different health departments in different states are starting to take this on as part of their health screening. But what has to happen on the other end is that in adulthood, we need to have a paradigm in which practitioners, as your caller so rightly pointed out, have the time in the exam room to ask these questions, that they're trained to ask these questions, and this is a really radical shift in the five-minute visit that most people have when they go into their doctor's office. When a recent study was done, more than half of Americans said that although they have come to understand, and this was done by the APA, the American Psychological Association, about 2 weeks ago, released a study, more than half of Americans say that they would like help managing their stress levels, that they understand it's not healthy to live in what they may not call a state of fight or flight, but they understand it doesn't feel good, that their stress levels are rising, but when they go in to see their doctor, stress is never discussed. Even though we now understand the relationship between stress and well-being and physical cellular health. So imagine how much further we have to go to get to the underlying question that my doctor asks me, which is what piece of this could have been established in childhood for setting your stress inflammatory response.
Yeah, and it also makes you wonder, doesn't it, that we need to think about what we can do to help kids whose lives are experiencing some of these traumas. I mean, because, you know, we're never going to live in a world where everyone's parents are perfect and no one dies unexpectedly and everyone's life goes smoothly. But so don't we have to help kids earlier on instead of waiting till they get these conditions when they're 40, 50 years old?
Excellent. Excellent question. We are starting to see a lot of work coming out of our major research institutions looking at that exactly. And what we're starting to find and what the literature is showing is that the good news is that when you help families to understand this and the awareness is there, families are more likely to reach out and say, okay, so here's some counseling that we can go through as a family, or here's, we want to make sure that a child going through this particular situation is getting a hand extended to them by a loving and caring adult. And the thing that we're finding is most protective for kids who are going through adverse childhood experiences is a very simple thing and a beautiful thing, and that is a consistent and loving adult who is there for them on a regular basis, regardless of what they might be going through. It doesn't have to even be a parent, but one person in childhood who extends that loving heart and is there is a very protective thing in and of itself. Now, that's a difficult thing to put into any piece of legislation, but mm-hmm. It is a very simple and accessible thing that we can reach out to the children in our lives and see the stress that they're experiencing in a very different way. It also pulls into question a great, great new subset of this research is focusing on bullying and how bullying can change the brain of a young child and their stress reactivity and inflammatory response for life. So this changes, right, how a school would look at bullying policy, because kids who were bullied in childhood to a certain degree, a certain level of bullying, their brains look different in adulthood.
Wow. Well, that is coincidentally something else we're going to be talking about on the show in the next couple of weeks. So hopefully we'll get more into it then. But that's so interesting. We're talking this hour with Donna Jackson Nakazawa. She is an award-winning science journalist with a new book that's called The Last Best Cure, talking about using the brain in techniques like meditation, acupuncture, exercise, yoga to reduce the stress response in the body and help come back from some of these really prevalent chronic conditions that lots of people have, one in two adults, in fact. And we want to know what you think. If this sounds familiar to you, what have you tried and what has worked for you? And what do you think about this new model of looking at childhood adverse experiences, too? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also check in and say your piece on our Facebook page at The Veronica Rickard Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickard back with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And I hope you'll stick around with us next hour as we talk about the songs that have become the most powerful ones in our lives that really flip our emotional switch and sometimes become like miniature time machines that hold some of our most powerful memories. So we're talking songs next hour. This hour, we're talking with Donna Jackson Nakazawa. She's an award-winning science journalist with a new book called The Last Best Cure. And we'll take another phone call now. We've got Susan joining us from Neshota. Hey, Susan.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
You know, I can so relate to everything that you've said. I'm 54 years old, and I would score very high on the ACE score questionnaire.
Mm-hmm.
I had been diagnosed at the age of 14 with systemic lupus, and have suffered most of my life with some type of an autoimmune issue or not. But back in the day when I was first diagnosed, I happened to be introduced to a meditation course called Cybionics, and we were kind of guinea pigs, so we had a number of our friends that got together, and they gave us flashcards for all the different systems of the body, such as the nervous, skeletal, circulatory, and then the five senses. And we were taught how to handle pain and stress and do things like in our imagination, if you had a headache, to go into meditation and bathe your head in warm light or ease your nerves by spray painting them. I had all the little cures for all that. And what was interesting is my lupus went into remission.
Mm-hmm.
I later on grew up and kind of forgot about that and thought maybe they were wrong or, you know, whatnot. My younger brother called me. He was discharged from the service with discoid lupus. And I said, Michael, I said, why would you have discoid and I have systemic? I said, I think you need to get home and get some. Well, the sad end of that story is Michael passed away at 32.
Sorry.
He had kidney transplant and then cancer. I since lost my sister to cervical cancer, and at the same time, I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and so I'm a 5-year survivor. I guess some of those things that I hear you say, I so relate to. I've had constant state of inflammation. People don't want to talk to me anymore. I don't like going to doctors that because they think I'm kind of a head case. And I say, fine. I said, you know, so I did turn to alternative medicine. I haven't quite learned how to flip that switch altogether. I'm one that I forget to take my vitamins. I guess I'm human.
Right. Yeah. Well, Susan, thank you so much for telling your story. It always helps for other people to hear one person's story, because if you've gone through something like that and your family has, other people have too. And I'm curious about, Donna, what you would tell Susan, given what you went through.
Well, I would say, first of all, that Susan is really brave, and these are the kinds of stories that I hear every day from readers, and they humble me because this is just such a great amount of stress that she's faced clearly in her life and with her family, and the braveness and the courage and the heart are really something to bow down to. So first, bows to her. And second, I would say that the very question of how do I flip that switch, and I think those are the words she used, is the most important question to ask. And I think once we begin asking that question, how can I flip this switch? It doesn't feel good to be on the pain channel, whether it's the emotional stressors or physical symptoms or worries about physical symptoms. The pain channel really feels bad. How do I flip the switch to get off of the stress now system, onto the purr now system, and onto the life channel? Every single time you ask that question, you're giving the brain a chance to change. So, for instance, we know this is true because in a simple act of trying to stay with the breath in mindfulness, or MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, we know that even when we are able to do that, and I write about this in the book, for just a few seconds, we already begin to retrain the brain away from the damage that might have been done from adult stress or childhood stress. We begin to learn how to enter that pause and stop that inflammatory response that's coming out of the neurochemicals of our brain. So just by saying, hey, I would like to be able to flip that switch, maybe I'm not great at it, but I'm interested in that question, she's already begun the change.
And it sounds like inflammation is at the core of all of this, right? Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, the chemicals that we worry about that are coming out of the stress response, the cortisol and the neurochemical mix, along with the inflammatory cytokines, what we call IL-6 and IL-1, which are linked to every major immune-mediated disorder we know. So, for instance, in somebody with lupus or chronic neurological autoimmune conditions, we're going to see heightened levels of IL-6, which are the same cytokines we see, which are elevated in the stress response. So these go hand in hand. And again, to bring that home to people, what we're starting to understand in the lab is that the stress toxins or neurochemicals that flush through the body when we are in a state of fight or flight really don't look that different to the body than a chemical toxic hit.
Wow.
So when we understand that, it gives us a new impetus and a charge to flip our switch, as your caller put it.
Right.
So you're right. It really, this, the neurochemical stress. Again, I'm a big one for analogies for readers. As a science writer, I think it's always helpful to give an analogy to break it down into something much simpler. The analogy I give is given to me actually by a scientist in psychoneuroimmunology, that we have a choice between the negative floating brain, literally this chemical cocktail that is manufactured in our brain as we react in real time to the world around us and travels through our body, causing inflammation and cellular breakdown. We have a choice to be putting forth this negative floating brain or to flip the switch to a positive floating brain. And that is the difference between the stress chemicals bathing our body and not bathing our body.
Well, I want to thank Susan so much for calling. And let's get to an email here. This says, I'm a multiple abuse survivor with rheumatoid arthritis and fibromyalgia and other autoimmune issues. How does repressed anger contribute, and how do I release and transform this?
Wonderful question, and I would start with a mindfulness-based stress reduction course, because one thing I learned from the amazing teachers I studied with, and I want to make it clear for listeners, that I did not go away to an ashram or disappear from the world. I worked full-time, raised my children, went to my doctor's appointments in the middle of doing this. So I went local. I went to whatever courses were being offered in my community that were affordable through community centers. So one thing I don't want to leave listeners with is the idea that I did this in some kind of a special way. I just went out into my community to local community centers, found teachers, found an incredible woman who, as I said, also taught at Hopkins, teaching MBSR in my community. And to begin that, one of the things she taught me in that process was life-changing, and that was that I didn't have to think about any of the bad things that had happened when I was young or the very painful years that we went through as a family, where, as I said, my father's death was like a domino that caused a number of other things to happen that were really traumatic for us as a family. And I didn't have to go into that and ask questions about it and try to relieve that terrible pain and anger that I felt toward a number of individuals who had played into our family's experience. I first had to learn the skills of mindfulness, learn to step away from my thinking. And one thing my meditation teacher, Trish McGarry, taught me was that later I would be in a much better place if I learned the techniques of mindfulness to handle whatever feelings came up. And as you can read in the book, later those feelings did come up, and I did have to deal with them. But I had the strength to handle them in a way that I never would have if I had not tried to flip the switch.
Hmm. Well, I wish that emailer good luck with their issues. And we're getting close to the end of the show, and I want to touch on, you know, we've talked about mindfulness, we talked a bit about yoga. What about acupuncture? Because that's part of this too. How does that fit into the puzzle of healing?
Well, as I said, we wanted to start with what I could do inside my own brain and then move to the full outside of the body itself through yoga and exercise and find out about how changing the way that I acted with my body could change my brain. So change the brain, change the body. And then to the very outside, what were things that might happen that I could go and have a practitioner do with me and for me that were affordable and accessible, covered by insurance? And I began to uncover the research on acupuncture and see that a number of studies were coming out showing that when a practitioner works on these pathways in the body.
And we have about 30 seconds left, Donna.
Through acupuncture, they were literally seeing some of these similar changes in the brain that we get through these other modalities. And so I gave it a try, and I could feel the change happening as I went through the course of treatment.
Well, Donna, it's been so interesting to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us this hour, and it was just fascinating hearing about the journey that you went on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Donna Jackson Nakazawa, our guest this hour. She's an award-winning science journalist, and her new book, the one we've been discussing this hour, is called The Last Best Cure. I want to thank Marika Suval for producing this hour and Dave Potras for doing our technical direction. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.